continue to resist, continue to build community. Thank you all for participating. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for our callers who recommended books and actions. So much we can do. Stay tuned to more on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. This has been More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I will see you, well, I won't see you, but I'll speak with you next time. Thank you, Nate, our engineer this morning.
Send on now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I host a show entitled A Matter of Public Records that is broadcast on KBOO the second and fourth Saturdays of every month from 3 to 6 a.m. It is a somewhat eclectic show where the song choices are often instinctual, based on the prior song. Tune in and you might hear some instrumentals, some slightly avant-garde music, punk, post-punk, indie rock, jazz. To my ears, it is a classic late-night radio show. That's A Matter of Public Records, every second and fourth Saturday from 3 to 6 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. And today, on The Old Mole Against the Grain, and C.S. Tsung asked the question, what does feudalism, or a new iteration of feudalism, have to do with capitalism and capitalist dynamics today? We'll hear from C.S. Tsung talking with Jody Dean about her new book, Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. Here's C.S. Tsung for Against the Grain and The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio.
Lords, serfs, and vassals. These figures may seem to belong to the distant past, a past of European castles and fields and fortresses, but discussion of feudal dynamics in the present, in what's playing out on the political economic level today, is growing, and a new book by Jody Dean is bound to push that discourse further. The book is Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. A professor of politics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Jody Dean teaches political, feminist, and media theory. When Jody and I connected recently, I asked whether she believes capitalism's days are over.
I don't think capitalism is dead. I think it's in the process of killing itself. And so right now we're in a transition time where we don't know is capitalism going to rejuvenate itself? Is it going to keep plodding on in its old senile way? Is it going to kill itself, or is it going to be overthrown with a great deal of excitement and dynamism? And my thesis in this book is that it's in the process of killing itself.
You write that we can't understand what capitalism might be changing itself into if we can't say what is distinctive about capitalism. What would you say if you had to choose maybe three things that were distinctive about capitalism as you understand it, what would they be? What would you say?
What makes capitalism distinctive are its specific dynamics or laws of motion. So capitalism is driven to invest in order to maximize profits and to improve, right? So it wants to invest, reinvest the proceeds rather than eating them. It wants to try to improve because of market competition, and it wants to try to maximize profits. So we always know that capitalism involves wage labor and private property, and there's a specific set of dynamics, and those are what I'm interested in, these dynamics of maximizing profit, investment, and improvement.
Maximizing profit. So a lot of people would say, well, that does characterize what we have today, that capitalists, regardless of how they're trying to make their money, they are trying to make money and as much as they can. So would you say that as far as profit maximization and the pursuit of profits, that the current version of capitalism is meeting that definition?
What's distinctive right now is the way that the drive for profits is actually leading to kinds of destruction and kinds of hoarding and a lack of investment. So what's interesting under what I'm talking about as neo-feudalism is how capital's laws of motion or its basic dynamics are coming into contradiction with themselves. So when we think about capitalism and a kind of classical age of the rise of industry and free markets, we think about capitalists as having means of production, like a factory and machinery, buying raw materials and employing labor. And they do this in order to make a profit, right? They own whatever it is that labor produces. Right now, what we're seeing is that large numbers of capitalists or large accumulations of capital don't think that production is going to be the way that they're going to make profit. And so instead of investing in production, they're doing two different kinds of things. One of those kinds of things is engaging in massive destruction, right? Destroying entire sectors in order to have a monopoly position. And the other thing they're doing is forms of rent, is relying on rents and fees and extraction. So they're not investing in production. They're not making, they're taking. And this is one of the things that is interesting about what capitalism is doing right now. It seems on the one hand to be doing what it's always done, which is try to make profit. But unable to make profit, it goes into different directions of rent extraction and destruction.
And what do you mean by rent? And give us an example of the sorts of rents and fees that capitalists are extracting from the rest of us that you argue constitute a greater and greater proportion of profits, of the way that people, the ruling class, make their money.
Some of the best examples of this move into rents come from big tech like Amazon or Uber or WeWork or Microsoft with its Azure platform. So I'll use Amazon as an example. The different sellers on Amazon pay fees to Amazon or rents, Right? So in order to sell, they have to pay various, you know, they have to pay a cut to Amazon. And then Amazon also gives them various kinds of incentives to use their, you know, storage services and delivery services, and then their advertising. And if the seller doesn't engage in those, if they don't go ahead and purchase these extras, then they get pushed way down in the search results. Additionally, if the seller sells on other platforms, they get pushed way down in search results. And so there's a strange way that Amazon is making its money, not just from one layer of rent extraction, right? Let's say like a store in a mall might pay rent to a mall owner, but through a set of increasingly intensive extras that the seller cannot avoid paying. So that's the primary way that Amazon is making its money. Amazon Web Services is another way where companies will use Amazon services because they can't afford the massive amounts of servers and energy that Amazon can. Amazon has built up this incredible amount of fixed capital, and so businesses will pay it a whole bunch of different fees in order to, you know, store their data, access their data, you know, run compute time on their data. So Amazon's making money through rents rather than through making anything. My argument is that rents are larger percentages of the economy. Other kinds of rents include financial services and these kind of strange financial derivatives that pay various kinds of benefits to those who own it, right? Various kinds of proceeds to those who own it and extract fees from those who don't. Another way we can think about this, we have to pay fees for everything all the time. A number of fees in our lives are increasing dramatically. Another kind of example, the structure of Uber is to extract what I think of as a rent from the drivers, right? Uber doesn't employ drivers. Uber takes a cut of the transaction between the customer and the driver. So again, that's a kind of rent. Now we can go into more details of a discussion of monopoly rents, which is the ability of a company with a monopoly on a good to extract more than it normally would in a competitive environment. But the idea that I think that people should come away with is how much of the economy now is being structured around taking, not making. We want to say profit, but it's really a rent. But the accumulation strategy is not one that's being pursued via trying to make more and more things. The accumulation strategy involves taking more and more in various kinds of ways. One last example would be intellectual property, right? Intellectual property, if we think about it in pharmaceuticals, we all know it's heartbreaking and ridiculous and obscene that a pharmaceutical company or an owner of a particular patent can force payments and fees for that drug that are astronomical when it should actually be free to anybody who needs it, or when it should be available at a very low amount for anyone who needs it. It's because of their intellectual property right in that drug. So they use the intellectual property right to extract a fee. And that's how they make their money. They're not actually making more of the drug and driving the price down. They're holding on to it and letting the price go up.
Jody Dean joins me on Against the Grain. She teaches political, feminist, and media theory at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. We're talking about her new book, Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. One sector of the economy, and you gestured toward it when you were talking about Uber, has apparently nothing to do with the production of commodities as well, which is the service sector. And you focus on this sector quite a bit in your book. What sorts of jobs does the service sector encompass? And And what proportion of jobs worldwide are in services?
The majority of jobs worldwide are in services. The one part of the world where there's still a majority in industry is the Middle East and the Arab world, in part because of oil. There's some places where agriculture is still strong, but services are kind of winning out. Like India is strange that way. They've moved directly from primarily agriculture to a majority in services. So yes, they still have agriculture, but there's a slight more majority in terms of the GDP that's coming from services. In the so-called developed countries, over 70% of jobs are in services. In the United States right now, I think it's about 79%. So the first thing to note is services are a majority of positions globally, and they're growing. The next thing to note is it's an incredibly vast area. And one might think that to speak of services is a little nuts because it goes from everything from, say, like, you know, lawyers and financial services and consultants and these really high paid jobs down to things like, you know, trash pickers, babysitters, you know, porters, and then drivers. And then in more what we might think of roughly in the middle, teachers and nurses, personal trainers, cleaners, cooks. But it's a whole variety of labor that is engaged in providing work that's not actually making something, but it's performing a kind of service, and that the purchaser is buying the specific service. And I think it's interesting in a lot of different ways. One way has to do with just if we think about particularly the what we might call personal services and then the health services. Much of this work is really necessary, as we saw during COVID, but it's not well compensated at all. We feel that it's necessary, but it doesn't continue to be compensated, right? It doesn't, like, this is one of the shocking things about COVID was how necessary the labor was. And we kind of thought for a while, like, oh, we're going to have a giant cultural shakedown that lets us properly compensate the things that we need the most. But that didn't happen. So I think one of the things we need to start thinking about with services is how much of it is necessary, but poorly compensated, and how there are parts of it that are really unnecessary or unnecessary except for the very, very wealthy, except for a billionaire class who needs all sorts of lawyers and financial analysts and consultants to help them. And that work is very highly compensated. So I think the first thing is it is a very broad sector, but it's a sector, roughly speaking, that in Marxist terminology, would not be called productive labor. It would be understood as a kind of unproductive but necessary labor.
What about service work strikes you as having a feudal character? And, you know, you write about feudalism and you write about neo-feudalism, and they're two different things. But in terms of just sort of classical understandings of feudalism, what is it about service work that makes you think of feudal dynamics?
There are a couple of aspects of contemporary service work that resonate with feudalism. One of those aspects is being a servant, right? Serving the consumption needs of a lordly class. These would be positions like, you know, hairdressers and nail techs, also home health aides, where what their work is to attend to the personal consumption needs of those who are able to pay, much like servants on a manor. Another aspect of contemporary service work that resonates with feudalism, and again, like you said, we're not talking about, you know, neo-feudalism at this exact moment, is serfdom. And the characteristic of serfdom was being trapped, and being trapped to work for the Lord, right? You had no choice. When you worked, you were working for the Lord. If you were farming, you were farming the Lord's land, and the Lord would take a cut of what you're doing. There's an element today of an inability to work except in a way that will provide for the consumption needs of a lordly class that is a characteristic of contemporary unfreedom. So if we use back the Uber example, they can't get rides if Uber doesn't take a cut. The same thing with any delivery person, right? They can't deliver unless the app doesn't take a cut. And then you have other kinds of work where the there's someone else who's going to take a cut repeatedly. That has to do whenever we're doing anything online as our data is gathered and used, in addition to the various kinds of fees we pay. So this element of this kind of intermediary platform, app, or taker from whom we can't escape gives contemporary work a kind of feudal quality of serfdom, right? Where no matter what we do, we're doing it for the benefit of a lord.
And to stick with feudalism for a bit longer, you write that accumulation strategies typical of feudalism are rent seeking. Well, we've talked a little bit about that, plunder, and political control. And sometimes you use the word predation instead of plunder, and certainly hoarding comes up quite a bit in your understanding of feudal dynamics. Talk about plunder and political control and what that meant in terms of feudal society, and maybe how some of those features might resonate today.
So when we're thinking about feudalism as a set of economic relations, we recognize that the structure wasn't one of building factories and employing wage labor and making commodities that would then be sold on a market and traded. The model is much more, here's some subsistence labor that is being carried out, and a lot of the top of it is being taken or seized by the stronger for their benefit. And the stronger will be predatory on various other fortresses or accumulations and try to strengthen their hold and position vis-a-vis another group, right? So I'm just thinking of like sort of fortresses and castles and a strong lord who needs to keep his strength, and then who will also be under the sway of another lord who wants to have his strength and may call upon his vassal for some kind of benefit. So the basic idea, though, is that there's a kind of chain of power and authority, and the top takes from the one below, and the one below takes from below, and so on and so forth. So it's a network of domination, a network of direct domination, where predatory behavior is the way to accumulate, not, say, productive or investing behavior. It's just basic predation, just taking, and so the stronger win. One of the things that's interesting about our present neo-feudal setting is how predatory the big companies are. They will eat up other companies, just buy them or drive them into the ground rather than improve on their own. So they'll just buy up another one. So that's a kind of predation. They also are predatory on communities, countries, states that are weak. They can drive down local communities through insistence on tax breaks. And local communities really will feel like they have no choice but to give them those tax breaks because things are going so badly. Right? So they're like, okay, sure, Amazon, build a warehouse here. We need the job so desperately. But they're not going to benefit from them very much because the jobs are low paid, the jobs are temporary, and they've given so much in tax breaks that they're not going to get a benefit. They're going to get more of a drain. And so that would be like the warehouses and call centers are just one example of this. But this predatory behavior, right, let's say searching for places to incorporate, places to bring lawsuits, places to establish a warehouse or establish a distribution center, all of this is done in a way that's directly predatory on, sometimes it's predatory on benefits, right? Like the benefits that an area might have because it has good schools. But what the predatory company does is drive down those schools by not paying its taxes. So the generalized atmosphere is one where, and I think everybody tends to feel this, is that the companies are engaged with society in a way that's directly about their enrichment and never about social good. This is not in any way a sense of corporations having social responsibility. The mode is one of communities being basically food and fodder for the success and power of the corporation.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. That's author Jody Dean, who teaches politics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, speaking with Against the Grain host Sia Soong about social responsibility, inspired by her new book, Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle, for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And you're hearing it here on KBOO Community Radio. Without further ado, here's more from their conversation, recorded last month for KPFA in Berkeley, California. Here's Sia Soong for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jody Dean joins me. Her books include Crowds and Party, The Communist Horizon, and Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies. We are talking about her new book, Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. It's published by Verso. So you've begun to talk about neo-feudalism, like the way in which you see capitalism transitioning, maybe society and economy moving away from capitalism into a new neo-feudal regimen. And in one section of your book, you go through neo-feudalism's characteristics. And one of them is fragmented power. I guess the fancy term is parcellated sovereignty. And I think this does relate to what happened in feudal times in Europe as well. The fragmentation of power, what's an example of that back in feudal times, and how is that manifesting today?
The feudal account of the fragmentation of power is often associated with the decline of the Roman Empire and the breakup of that empire into city-states, small localities, warring bands. But it's the absence of that overarching Roman power and the kind of thousand-year period of have different kinds of formations, whether or not those are successful city-states, as in some places, or increasingly smaller localities that are somewhat isolated or dependent on protection, the protection of some kind of stronger lord or somebody with enough of an army to secure them in an insecure time. So the breakup of the Roman Empire is one of the kind of classic examples of the fragmentation of power or parcellated sovereignty. In the present, we see this with the rise of free trade zones and the way that these free trade zones are spaces that are extracted in a way from a country in that they're no longer subject to that country's laws. Often it's environmental laws, but maybe also forms of commercial and labor regulation. But they're little zones where the laws of that country don't apply in the same way. That's one kind of example of that. Let's see, the other kinds of examples of parcellated sovereignty would be things like, you know, Banustans. I would say the fragmentation of you know, of Palestine into the West Bank and Gaza. That's a kind of parcelization. In general, we see this in the U.S. in all sorts of gated communities that have their own private security. But it's places where there is a kind of extraction away from a larger whole.
The second feature of neo-feudalism that you point to concerns social property relations, and you use new lords and serfs, I'm reading here, to designate neo-feudalism's forms of hierarchy and expropriation. What do you want to stress about this new landscape of hierarchy and domination?
We need to think about the impact of 40 years of neoliberalism. My argument in Capital's Grave is that the impact is one that's turning our societies into societies that look more like feudalism than they do like capitalism, societies that I'm thinking of as neo-feudal. So one of the impacts of 40 years of neoliberalism has been the rise of a service sector, and that has entailed a hollowing out of the middle class and rise of a small elite billionaire class or top 1% or 0.1%, and an enormous number of people who are struggling to get by. One of the things that this does is create a labor supply for people in the low end of the wage scale for services. And it creates an elite that, you know, has material goods that they don't know what to do with, they've got so many, but are more and more desiring to pay for various kinds of personal services or, you know, any kind of services that will help them either as companies or as individuals or as a class. And so more people end up in positions where what they do is serve the consumption needs of the very wealthy. Culturally, we are seeing this take place in a kind of accepting way. One of the most ridiculous examples is the way that airlines board passengers and will say, oh, here, group one, you walk on this little red carpet. Group two, we're going to this blue carpet, which is right next to the red one, right next to it, going in the same door. We're going to chain off the red carpet, and you're going to walk down the blue carpet. And people accept this, right? This very bizarre kind of hierarchy of red carpets and blue carpets, as if this made sense, as if this were anything but the inscription of a status differential or an order of privilege. So one of the things that is happening as we have this dramatic increase in inequality and rising sector of services is a sense of the properness of privilege and the expectation of subservience. And this is dangerous. It's dangerous for democracy. It's dangerous for freedom. And it's already a dramatic undermining of even the possibility of thinking in terms of equality.
So you've talked about the rise in services. You've talked about the way that multinational corporations can sort of throw their weight around. You've talked about the financialization of the economy and the ways in which privilege operates or maybe increasingly operates. I guess my question is, you know, for years, for decades, these kinds of phenomena have been around, right? Multinational corporations trying to get their way with countries outside the U.S., the super rich having people wait on them and do things for them in terms of services, the financialization of the economy. This has been going on for a long time. It's a phenomenon well documented. So I guess my question is there an acceleration of these kinds of things? And I guess in line with that, you know, this idea that, sure, Marx thought of capitalism as involving in a very integral way the the making of things, the production of commodities, the making of profits off the selling of commodities, which were produced by exploited factory workers. But in some ways, you know, if Marx were alive today, and maybe this is a question you get a lot from your students, wouldn't he just say, well, this is just capitalism evolving. This is what happens when a certain kind of industrialization phase plays out and profits become more difficult to gain, to make, based on the production of, like, you know, actual things that are then sold to people. So kind of a long-winded way to say, or way to ask, how are some of these features that you're talking about so new and so prominent that it deserves to be thought of as a new stage, a stage perhaps beyond capitalism that capitalism looks like it's moving into?
Neo-feudalism designates an accumulation of effects. It designates a tendency that is unfolding because of the kinds of processes you just mentioned in your question, right? Profits are becoming more difficult. And so the response of asset holders is to try to take. It's to try to use the political system more and more for this taking. It's to use the political system to grab wealth, right? To take it from the state, to take it from the communities, as we've been seeing really vividly since Trump and Musk became president. So I think that the first thing to note that I want to emphasize here is that neo-feudalism is a way to think about how these effects accumulate and start to become something different from what they were. You know, if the wealth strategy is going and grabbing the wealth, right, that's predation. That's not a capitalist form of accumulation. Now, you asked about, you know, wouldn't Marx just say this is capital evolving? And I think no, because Marx didn't think of capitalism as a kind of eternal form. It didn't always exist. He didn't think it would always exist. He thought that its grave would be built by the proletariat and usher in, whether or not in a revolutionary way or a developmental way, you know, there's debates on that, but it would usher in socialism. But he never thought that capitalism would just continuously evolve. Right? So my argument is that capitalism can change itself into something else, into something that is heavily and more heavily reliant on non-capitalist economic forms.
My guest is Jody Dean. She teaches political, feminist, and media theory. We're talking about her new book, Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. We have a link to that book and to Jody's faculty page on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. In your discussion about a new lords and serfs, you also write about an international class of super rich asset holders who are increasingly shielding themselves from the rest of us. Talk about that phenomenon.
One of the things that we see internationally as well as nationally is how the super wealthy, right, the class that I've been talking about as new lords, how they're able to shield themselves from all sorts of public responsibilities. So we saw, we saw this, you know, publicized how much wealth they're hoarding in offshore accounts to avoid taxations. We know about their various, you know, fantasies of private islands and super yachts that function almost as if they were autonomous territories, again, in order to evade state law. For a long time, we've talked about gated communities, private schools with their private planes, private security, right? I think it's California and Florida that have these, a very large number of companies that are private security companies. And one of what this means is that there's a class of people who increasingly separate their interests from those of their communities, those of their countries. Their interest is primarily their class interest, and that's what they're willing to pay for, right? Private security, private planes, but nothing that has any kind of public dimension.
And two other attributes of neo-feudalism that you present in this book, Capital's Grave, is hinterlandization, the consigning of hinterlands to a sort of oblivion. And these are places, these are geographical locations, typically outside cities, and anxiety, catastrophic anxiety. We don't have a lot of time. We don't have enough time to talk about each of these in detail, but what do you want to stress about these two particular features?
These two aspects of neo-feudalism, right? The rise of hinterlands or hinterlandization, and a kind of pervasive feeling of catastrophe and anxiety and a kind of almost psychosis about not understanding what's going on in the midst of so much devastation. Those can be thought together, I think, when we recall the declining life expectancy in the United States, the rise of these diseases of despair with forms of substance abuse and dependency and violence. When we think about the ecological devastation in so much of the areas surrounding cities, you know, where I live in between two giant dumps, and you can sometimes smell 5-10 miles away, you can smell the air and smell of the dumps. And it's an area with strip malls, most of which are vacant. The hospitals are closing, the schools are closing, and there's a kind of sense of generalized abandonment that then adds to a feeling of catastrophism and that no one cares. So what I'm trying to do with the neo-feudal idea is bring together a set of ideas that people talk about, and they talk about a lot, right? They talk about these tech lords, they talk about services, they talk about the kinds of tent cities around a big city like LA or Seattle and within it. They talk about the abandoned areas, and they talk about the generalized sense of, oh my God, you know, we're not doing anything about climate change. We're not doing anything about the evisceration of our social welfare net. We're not doing really anything about anything. These all go together, and they go together in this generalized idea of neo-feudalism. Like, we can, in brief, one might think about it, you know, capitalism had, even for Marx, a degree of progress in it. Even with the devastation that it brought about, it was considered to be ushering in a kind of future, building the infrastructure that would be necessary for socialism. So yes, capitalism was immiserating, but it built new industry, it centralized and concentrated workers into ways that would enable a socialist government. What's happened after 40 years of neoliberalism is a destruction that's quite great, that has undermined any sense of possibility. And so capitalism, in its neo-feudal tendency, is one that has destroyed any progressive dimension.
And we haven't talked much about the role that land plays in neo-feudalism. What do you want to emphasize about that?
On the one hand, land is in a somewhat different position in neo-feudalism than it is under feudalism proper, because under feudalism proper, it was the asset that people were fighting over. And today we have a variety of different asset classes, right? We already spoke of intellectual property as one of those. Data and information would be another one. But land, nevertheless, you know, so on this other hand, is going to be crucial and is crucial under neo-feudalism, in part because of climate change and the land struggles that are going to that are already occurring as agricultural land becomes more expensive. Weirdly, like I found this weird, Bill Gates is one of the largest agricultural land owners in the United States. I was like, why does he need that? But he's been buying up land. The King of England or the English crown remains still, weirdly, right? We would think in a contemporary world, it wouldn't be some monarchy that owns the most land in the world, but here we are. So land grabs are increasingly part of our world and then hoarding. So I think that even as we tend to be concerned about more technological questions, that land remains a site that's indicative of our neo-feudal present.
So in a section of your book about combating neo-feudalism, you return to this emphasis on service workers and the service sector. What political potential do you see from this vast sector of huge numbers of servants, nationally and internationally, in terms of their ability to ward off or stop neo-feudalism in its tracks?
When we look worldwide at where most labor struggles are coming from, what we see are striking doctors, nurses, teachers, baggage handlers, baristas, graduate students, childcare providers, domestic workers, right? Globally, any given month, you'll see that most of the labor organizing and strikes and protests are coming out of the service sector. This is tremendously exciting because it tells us that this is a place where there is real organizing going on and where people are seeing their struggles as struggles that will benefit all of society. Teacher struggles are really strong that way because they are struggles that say, look, you know, our working conditions are your future. Our working conditions are the lives of your children. So first, we need to look at the service sector because that's a place where struggles are already happening and it's tremendously exciting. We also need to look at the service sector as the bearers of a future beyond that of just catering to the consumption requirements of a lordly class, right? They can actually give us a vision of an economy under climate change, an economy on a warming planet. Here's why. On a warming planet, we cannot continue to expand industrial production. I think everyone knows that, right? We have to find ways to continue to focus, consolidate, limit industrial production so that it's meeting basic needs rather than just say, you know, fulfilling the consumption requirements of a lordly class. Service work makes us have to think about work based on needs, the needs of people and the planet. So let's say environmental restoration. That's a huge place for important and crucial work. Also caring for communities, health, teaching, right? Remaking, revitalizing. Because services are already the majority sector on the planet, because they're already not engaged in industrial production, we don't have to see them just as unproductive, right? In that narrow sense, we can see them as actually helping to realign our understanding of value so that it's not just, you know, exchange value in, you know, the old school sense, but rather the kind of use value that we need for thriving on under climate change.
Many people will have heard of universal basic income, which this book, Capital's Grave, presents a critique of. But I want to focus on universal basic services, which you support. What is UBS and why is that important to what you see as an egalitarian, justice-oriented economy and society.
So most of us are familiar with universal basic income as a kind of demand that is supposed to give everyone some kind of regular stipend or payment, and that it would be a redistributive measure. I think it's a huge mistake, not only because it was an idea associated with Milton Friedman and the right, but because it's oriented toward individual purchases. Universal basic services is not oriented toward just what an individual wants and a kind of commodity. Universal basic services looks at the broader array of non-commodities that all of us need to survive and thrive. Health, education, transportation, a clean environment, green space. Right? These are libraries, culture. These are aspects of our social life together that, for the most part, we have accepted as things that states should provide. They've been under increased attack. Under the last 40 years, they've withered away in many places. Though still, if you ask people, they might think, yes, you know, a good city has green space. A good city will have good public schools. But we need to make a primary demand in our general figuring of justice that we need to fight for. We need to make universal services a core of that demand. What it does is it gives the service sector, the service class, right, the sector of servants, it valorizes their work as containing a future for us all. And it directly ties their work with something that we need to survive. So I think universal basic services is the way to go, right? It's the way that the service sector is the carrier of universal demands.
In some ways, we've just scratched the surface of Jody Dean's new book. It's called Capital's Grave, Neo-Feudalism and the New Class Struggle. Jody teaches political feminist and media theory in Geneva, New York. Her other books include Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies, Communicative Capitalism and Left Politics, The Communist Horizon, and Crowds and Party. Jody, thanks for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
There's a crack up in the ceiling, and the kitchen sink is leaking. Out of work and got no money, a Sunday joint of bread and honey. What are we living for? Two room apartment on the second floor. No money coming in. Collectors not from trying to get in. We are strictly second class, and we don't understand. Hey, hey! We should be in Dead End Street. Hey, hey! People are living in Dead End Street. Hey, hey! I'm gonna die in Dead End Street. Chance to emigrate. I'm deep in debt now, it's much too late. We both want to work so hard, we can't get the chance. Hey! People in the dead end street. Hey! People are dying on dead end street. Hey! We're gonna die on dead end street.
Thank you.
This is Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. And the few minutes we have remaining allow us to present something James Barrett told me recently in connection with a book, A David Montgomery Reader, Essays on Capitalism and Worker Resistance. Jim had been talking about David Montgomery's focus on the everyday lives of workers in the U.S., and I asked whether the purpose of that scholarship was in part to help explain workers' willingness to mobilize to resist injustice in the workplace and possibly beyond.
Yeah, I think most labor historians, and I think it more or less applies to Montgomery, are interested in the relationship between everyday life and political mobilization, class conflict. But in characterizing him, and I think the best of the new labor history, within that interest, I'd want to save room for more typical experience. In other words, you could get the impression from some labor history that workers spent all of their time on strikes and were mainly interested in political ideas. And alas, if you know much about the history of the United States, that would be a gross distortion. I think that another thing that was kind of good about him, and some of the other new labor historians have picked up on it, is that it's probably as important to study defeats as victories. It's probably as important to study working class conservatism as it is working class radicalism. Both those elements are there, and you can find them. But the labor history of the United States has a lot of defeats in it. And the labor movement, just as one manifestation of working class life, has tended generally to be conservative. And so if you spend all your time rooting around for aspects of radicalism, I think you're gonna miss a lot. So it's the connection between everyday life on the one hand, and the kind of what you might call the presence of the working class in the United States. It wasn't always a radical presence, but it's very important, we feel, to document the presence and to study the presence.
James Barrett, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and co-editor with Shelton Stromquist of A David Montgomery Reader. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning.
And I'm John Nelson for the Old Mall Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio for the 5th of May, 2025. Thanks to producers Sasha Lilly and CS Soong, and guests Jody Dean and James Barrett. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced at KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. They're on the web at againstthegrain.org. You can find this episode of the Old Mall Variety Hour alongside other archived episodes in time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the KBOO website at kboo.fm.
KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition.